Hi, I'm Rick Colson. So I'm going to talk today about, and we're going to talk together a little bit about sustaining ministry and not burning out. Okay, and I'll introduce myself first, and then we'll get into it. So, I've lived in Oregon ever since I was married. Been married 36 years to my wife Kathy. Got two kids. I work at Intel. You know, I'm different than most people here. You know, I'm a senior fellow at Intel Corporation, and I do SSDs. You know what an SSD is, and that kind of thing. So I'm not I've never been employed by any ministry. Always Intel or some other company. And right now I'm working on artificial intelligence. And I don't know if you can see those things, but it's really weird the way it works. That's the only thing I want you to remember from this. It's really weird the way it works. Okay, so why talk about sustainability and burnout? Our society, I've heard, listened to a podcast in the last month, and a lot of times, several people said, our society is marked by anxiety, exhaustion, and stress as a culture. And I don't think that's unique to the non-Christian culture. I think that's true a lot of times in ministries as well. Certainly, and we'll talk about that. I don't want to say too much about that yet because I've got a slide coming up about it. But why me? I talk about this, and I've talked about it at probably the reason why I'm doing this series. I did it at a Plow Association chapel a while back, something that was similar to this. And I do this at Intel all the time. And I've actually given a version of this that has less of the scriptural foundation obvious all over the world for Intel. I've been like India and Vietnam and Poland and all of Intel's U.S. sites. I do this a lot at Intel. But I think it's not a unique, corporate America kind of problem. And the why me is I'm not good at this. I've really struggled with sustainability in my own life. Not that you would know it from the outside, because I've always seemed to actually, I don't overwork too much. I don't have any of the traditional kinds of things that people would say are unsustainable. But it turns out that I just constitutionally am not that strong, and it doesn't take that much to wipe me out. And so I've really had to deal with this. I got to a point, and we'll talk about it. I'll get to that of crisis in my own life and career, to the point where I had to take a medical leave of absence from Intel, like for 3 months. And I didn't know if I'd ever be able to go back, actually, or to do anything productive. Actually, I was so messed up at the time. And so this is sort of a cautionary tale, kind of don't do what I did. Hopefully you can learn from my mistakes and not have to make them fresh your own. So it's been a while now, but some years ago, when I was first named a fellow at Intel, which is like a vice president, it's sort of the technical equivalent of a vice president. And when I was first named a fellow, in that year, I started to notice I started having a lot of tension that I was carrying in my chest. For me, I was carrying it right here, and be like some days just really tight. And I also noticed that things that used to be easy, making decisions about some stuff, I'd be more paralyzed in terms of, should I do it this? Not clear decision, felt tired. Things that used to give me joy and energy weren't giving me joy and energy, and even exercise, which has always been my stress reducer, that didn't work. And I found myself one day, I was on a business trip down to California, and in the hotel that night, really bad chest tightness, and I was thinking, there's something really wrong with me. And then I went home to Portland, and I went to exercise. On the way home from the airport, I went to a gym, and I did about 5 minutes, and I was just too tired, I don't have the energy. And then that night, I woke up in the middle of the night, and it's like this was just killing me. And I woke up my wife and said, there's something really wrong with me. We actually called the hospital, and they said, don't drive, take an ambulance, come in, you're having a heart attack maybe, all this sort of stuff. And eventually I wasn't having a heart attack. It was just a panic attack, but which I had a lot of starting then. But you know, I went to all sorts of different people, a counselor at church, stress counselor, just a non-Christian, a psychiatrist, and kind of took a shotgun approach. How can I get better? And the insight to me was panic attacks sometimes are caused when your limbic system, kind of your unconscious reptile brain or whatever, would say there's something really wrong, like adrenaline, fight or flight, and your brain, conscious brain, doesn't even think anything's wrong, and it's kind of this mismatch between your body saying something's really messed up, I got a fight or flight, and your brain saying I don't know what it is. And so I learned a lot of stuff. It's kind of called generalized anxiety as disorder. And you know, I studied and I went to all these different people, learned a lot, took notes to myself, and that was, again, a fair amount of time ago, but it eventually came into this presentation. So I'm sharing this not because of strength. Like I said, it's something I have to work at myself. Okay? So I don't know how many of you guys know panic attacks, but it's not a fun experience. You think you're dying. It's not like you're stressed out about something. You think you're dying. And your heart attack, or you think you have cancer, or you know, I can't breathe. All those sort of things were happening to me. And then, you know, not everyone reacts to being in that space the same. You know, I was having panic attacks, but other people, you know, it's cut off a little bit, but you know, dysfunction, that problem, stomach aches, high blood sugar, weakened immune system, depression, insomnia, all that kind of stuff, if you let it get that far. And then that's on the anxiety side of things. Then for other people, it can be just generalized ill health or bad immune system or this or that. You know, there's just bad things happen to you if you don't take care of yourself. So on that note, you know, I have panic attacks, other people have different symptoms, and we're all different. So don't take anything I'm going to say like literally, in the sense of apply it without prayer and without customizing it for yourself. But my question is, so I told you I do this at Intel all the time. And Intel people always come and say, oh, thank you for talking about that. It's such a problem and most people don't talk about it. My guess is that applies just as much in vocational Christian circles as it does at Intel. Think that's true? Is this a problem that you think is around? You know, and I looked up some stuff and saw these graphics about pastoral burnout and started thinking about it. And I think it could even be worse, because not only do you have the economic pressure or the some of the pressures you have at a secular job, but you also have the extra pressure of why you're doing it. You know, if you get into a performance thing with God, you can feel that this is so important. This is, you know, Rick works at Intel. Okay, if he goofs up, it's just, you know, profit lost. If I goof up in ministry, it's like, you know, if that has eternal significance, you could say. So I think it might be worse. But anyway, so that's just the problem statement. So now let's talk about what we can do about it. I think you got to start with what would sustainability be? I'd say my definition is living in a way that you can effectively live out your calling for your whole life. You know, you don't do stuff. I mean, things happen, right? I mean, there's no guarantees that you're going to be, you know, well, live a long time or anything like that, or be healthy. But some things we can do can decreases our chances, if you know what I mean. You know, how can you live out your calling, have the capability to do whatever it is that God's called you to do for your whole life without having to say, well, you know, I'm not healthy enough, due to your own actions, not just because. Does that make sense? I'm not sure I'm communicating that clearly. Okay. Effectively living out your calling your whole life according to the way God made you, I think it's really important, and the circumstances He put you in. Right, you may have circumstances might be, you know, a special needs child. Okay, that would change the way you approach life, obviously. Or you're a person who needs a lot of sleep, or you're a person who doesn't need a lot of sleep. Those all change. So it's this all different. But it's for you and your circumstances, how can you live out for, let's say, you know, throughout your life, what God has called you to do. That's what I think sustainable is. And I also think it's important that the way other people see it is they see grace, truth, love, and a life they want that's attractive to people. I mean, if you're holding on and able to do some ministry, but you're driving yourself so hard, everybody looks at you and goes, oh, I wouldn't want to be in that person's shoes. You know, that life looks terrible. You know, super long hours, always exhausted, that kind of thing. And I don't think that's what God calls us to, because if you think about words in the Bible like Sabbath and my yoke is easy and my burden is light, it doesn't mean an easy time, but it doesn't mean driving ourselves like crazy. So this is supposed to be a little bit interactive. So either at your tables or to yourself, think about, are you, you know, this is still part of the setup, not the meat of the presentation, but are you experiencing anything that you would say is a symptom of not being sustainable in some practice that you have? Think about that for a minute, or talk about it at your table if you feel like it. Okay, like, so hopefully that was a little bit motivational, maybe, and you'll have more time in a minute, but hopefully that got you interested in staying for the rest of this time. Yeah. So the first thing I want to talk about is physical sustainability, you know, like our bodies, what we, you know, how many hours we work, our physical practices, what we eat, stuff like that. And then I'll go on to mental things and some spiritual things as we go. Like I said, this started at work. And, an organization that isn't known for valuing people, I mean, not that maybe they do, maybe they don't, but Harvard Business Review is not about people. It's about money, right? They published this really interesting article a while back called "The Research is Clear, Long Hours Backfire for People and for Companies," and I'll add in there, for God. I mean, nothing backfires for God, but you know what I mean. And this article is really interesting because it starts off and it says, does your job or your ministry depend upon creativity, controlling your emotions, discipline to work on the right things at the right time, reading people, understanding people, listening really well, you know. And so, do you do that best when you're exhausted, or do you do that best when you're fresh? It's a rhetorical question, right? Right. So that's how this article starts, and it goes on to And again, their only interest here is profit, right? Wall Street Journal, no, Harvard Business Review. Although there are similar ones I could have shown you from Wall Street Journal that say it's not good for people or for your company to have people work too hard. Now, what too hard is, it depends on people, because we're all different. But it's not good. Why is it not good? Well, for the reasons I said, when your job involves those things, you don't do them well if you're exhausted. And in fact, the research that these guys point to says that even if you enjoy what you're doing, and you're doing it not because somebody's driving you to do it, but because you want to do it yourself, you end up making so many mistakes that you're producing negative work. It would be better, and that's what this says. In a corporation, it'd be better for the corporation and better for the employee to just go home, right? It's not that you're getting less done, it's you're getting negative work done. And that's, you know, secular research from somebody who is not biased toward doing what's right for people. And I love the way it ends. In sum, the story of overwork is literally a story of diminishing returns. Keep overworking and you'll progressively work more stupidly on tasks that are increasingly meaningless. Okay? Progressively more stupidly on tasks that are increasingly meaningless. More stupidly is the mistake factor. Increasingly meaningless is referring to the fact that when we're tired or worn out, we tend to do the easiest stuff, not the most important stuff. Things that are more rote, things that are more mechanical. And those are things you can do when you're exhausted. The one exception to this, they say, if you have a job, like if you're mowing lawns, you can do that long hours. If you're thinking about strategy or, you know, interacting with people, you can't do it. Does that make sense? Who wants that to be the, we just got something on the projector. Who wants that to be the story of their life? You know, a tagline, maybe instead of a life verse, you know, he worked increasingly stupidly on tasks that are increasingly meaningless. Not me. And like I said, I'm not showing to you, but this is not just one publication. There's some stuff from Stanford, there's some stuff from Wall Street Journal about people finding that more focus, working less, got better results. And the article also talks about something called sleepless elite. And these are people who only need 6 hours of sleep a night, let's say, to be effective. Okay, and they get the same effectiveness with 6 hours sleep versus more. And it's interesting because 40% of the population believes that they are sleepless elite. Okay? And they do the measurements, and they say 1-3% of people who say they are, only 5% of people who identify themselves as sleepless elite actually are when they're tested. So people fool themselves. That's another theme of this article, is people aren't very good at gauging when they're effective or not, when they're kind of working too hard. And same thing with sleep thing. I'm doing fine with less sleep. Well, some people do. But a lot of people, most people who think they do, don't. Okay, so I found this really interesting article. So another thing along the same lines is the idea of anxious toil. Psalm 127, unless the Lord builds the house, those who build it labor in vain. Unless the Lord watches over the city, the watchmen stay awake in vain. It's in vain you rise up early, go late to rest, eating the bread of anxious toil, where he gives to his beloved even in their sleep. And that kind of, I think the point of that is, you know, our effort, our extreme effort, is not what does it, right? I mean, and I like the way John Piper summarizes it. God can perform more good for those who trust him while they sleep than they can perform with anxious labor for themselves when awake. And so that's kind of what God does. It's not a result, I mean, our hard work is a part of it, but not our hard overwork warping our lives to be driven in some way that isn't what God's calling. You guys tracking me? Yeah? Okay, good. This is something I just thought of. I mean, it's kind of obvious, but, you know, the whole idea of Sabbath and rest is pretty big deal to God, right? And why? And I'm not going to expand on that, but just point out that that's something. Okay, the next thing, sorry, I'm getting close to you guys, but I like to walk around. The next thing, so that was about hours worked and sleep. Next thing is about energy. And I don't know if you're like me. I'm actually 62 now, and the older I get, the more I find that I run out of energy before I run out of time. That wasn't true when I was younger, but now I run out of energy before time. But energy is a little bit more elastic than time is. Energy is something you can do a lot to change. This is a Intel hires this company called Tignum that does the executive as an athlete kind of thing, you know, like how, if you're a Mr. Executive, how do they train you so that you're most effective, you know, in terms of diet, exercise, rest, also all sorts of things about how you come off at work. But it's really interesting to me that they pointed out that you can't see the titles on this, but these are two pictures of the brain, one with hydration and one without hydration. Okay, and the point is, I'm not going to tell you what all that means, but if you could see closely, this one's got a lot more pits and weirdness to it. The point is they're different. Your brain physically is different if you're hydrated or not. Sleep, same thing, same kind of thing. This is with enough sleep, and that's not without enough sleep. And you see, it looks different. I can't tell you all the things about it, but it's just different. It matters to the way your brain actually physically is and how it works. Movement, this is a different kind of brain scan, but this is your brain when you're sitting quietly, and this is your brain when you're walking. This is after a 20-minute walk. You know, moving around, more blood flow, your brain has more stuff going on in it. That's your brain, not obviously the rest of your body, but your brain has more stuff going on in it. Those are some examples of how that this company, Tignum, would coach people about how to get their most performance. They also have things about taking breaks. You know, they would say, Intel, you're going to be more effective as a company if instead of running meetings back to back to back, you have a 15-minute break in between them so that people can absorb what's happened and think about what they want to, you know, what their follow-up is, and get in the place they're ready to deal with the next meeting. You know, we don't follow that advice, but they coach, say, look, it's better if you do it that way. So that energy, you can do a lot on energy. I personally find that if I'm going to have a productive afternoon, I need to work out at lunch if I can. And I do most of the time. The metric for you guys is not exactly earnings, but you can think of it as results or effectiveness in some way, is that there's a link that says that, hey, people who exercise earn 7% more than people who don't. You know, that's you can't quite exactly prove cause and effect. You can prove causality, correlation, but not cause and effect. But, and it says for women, it's even more than that, than the 7%. It's interesting, and that either means people who are disciplined to exercise are better at work, or people who exercise have more going on in their brain, more energy. That makes sense. Okay, and kind of, so that's the sleep, long hours, things like nutrition, like rest, and not just sleep, but little breaks during the day, movement, even how much water you drink, all are related to your ability to do things and be sustainable. And the next thing is, because this is kind of my summary of the sustainability part, physical sustainability part. You guys know who this guy is, Robert Murray McShane? He was this 18th century, or not 18th century, 1800s pastor, graduated from university at 14, had a church of 1,000 people at 23, completely burned out by the time he's 29. Completely. And then that's when he said this. You know, he had a calling. This is exactly the opposite of the statement about being able to do something for your whole life that you feel called to. Because he said, I had a message from God, and God gave me the horse, his body, and I killed the horse. And now he can't do what he feels God has called him to. And that's the opposite of sustainability, right? So my question to you is, which one do you want to be? Take a few minutes at your tables or to yourself and think about what would be the most important thing, whether something I mentioned or not, to improve your physical sustainability. Sleep, exercise, diet, whatever. Okay, we'll have more time at the end, probably, how we're doing, 46 minutes, okay. Yeah, we'll have more time at the end to talk about this more, and actually more Q&A if you want, but let's go on here. Okay, so that was physical stuff. You guys are having too much interaction. We gotta cut this off right now. This interpersonal stuff's gotta stop. Gotta stop. Tasks. I'm a task-oriented person, unfortunately, but it's mental sustainability. Okay, I like this slide. I don't know why. It looks like from a high school science fair. But I found there are a number of attitudes, and I think you can pretty easily trace them back to, well, I'm going to hopefully lead you to the point where you can see they're scriptural, about things you thought patterns, really. The first is, it's a marathon, not a sprint, right? If you're running a marathon, you do not start off running as fast as you can. Right? No one does that. It's a marathon. I tell this to people at work because there's this thing at work with, especially millennials, where they get concerned and they say things like, when they come to me for mentoring or something, hey, I've been at Intel. Intel's a 100,000 person company. I've been at Intel like a year now, and the CEO doesn't know me. Or, you know, I've been at Intel 2 years now, and I don't have any clear path to being a vice president. And it's like, hey, relax. Yeah, your career, let's say we're running a marathon, but we think in kilometers. It's 40-something. And just roughly, your career is like running a marathon in kilometers, and every year is just a kilometer of the marathon. It's got a long way to go. You don't have to get too worked up. Now, but most of us in this room are older, kind of already understand that. But it's interesting, I find at work, this is a huge problem, that people think everything's got to happen like now, and it doesn't. They're running as fast as they can. Yeah, yeah. Another important attitude is that when you make some, have some convictions or have some things you want to do about any of the stuff we're talking about, well, about anything, you know, you're the only one who can really keep those boundaries. A lot of times, at work, somebody say to me, hey, you know, I like that you work out at lunch, but hey, I can't do that because every time I try, somebody schedules a meeting right on top of it. And I say, hey, you know, unless it's the CEO or something, say no. You know, lunch is lunch. You don't have to do that. We don't have to do that. And one of the things this is kind of silly, but because I'm a senior person in Intel, one of my main things is saying no to things. Like somebody wanted to have a meeting at 7 a.m. every week or 6:30 or something like that. I go, why do we have this meeting at 6:30? And go, well, there's somebody in Israel who might want to call in and this would make it so it's at a good time for them. They go, have they ever called in? I just asked a question. They go, no. How many years have you been doing this meeting? Because I was new to it. Well, like 5 years. Okay, we are not having this meeting at 6:30 a.m. because somebody might call in, right, from Israel. Sorry, not doing it. But the thing is, you got to push back. People schedule meetings on my calendar at lunch all the time, and my admin says politely declines, right? And why are we doing this? Yeah, but and it's easier for me because I'm a more senior person, but I think we all, the only people who can hold these boundaries are us, right? Another really important one, I think, is we all are interacting with stuff that's really important, all sorts of stuff, too much stuff, more than we could possibly engage in a serious way. You know, my boss actually owns a vineyard, and why do they prune grapes? You know, because I mean, grapes are what they're trying to grow and what they make money off of. Why do they throw half of them away sometimes? Why?
To grow more later.
The ones that they leave then are better. So they'd rather have like half as many grapes, but have half as many excellent grapes than twice as many good grapes. And I think that applies to us in whatever we're doing. There's a lot of stuff we could be involved in, and we could have a little bit of involvement in something or do something okay. But why? I mean, we got to prune stuff and say, what are the most important things that I'm involved in? Whether, you know, that God is asking me to do or that are on my list to do at work, whatever. What are the most important ones? Because I'd rather have. And I think this is just generally true. It's certainly true even at Intel about results. A few things that are really important are way more valuable than a bunch of stuff that's kind of half done. You know, some people come to me again, I do this a lot at this stage in my career, people come to me and say, you know, I did these 30 things last year, and why am I not being promoted? And this other person did like two. Yeah, and they killed the things they did, and they were really important, and you touched 30 things. There is an article, one of the articles I refer to, something in the Wall Street Journal, where a guy, he said, now this is the wrong attitude he's had, but it's really informative. He said, he's an MBA, Harvard MBA or something, he's going to Wall Street, and he says, I started my job, I'm willing to do anything to advance, you know, that is it. I have no other values than moving up the corporate ladder. And he wrote this article, and he said, and I noticed that this woman who left at 5:30 every night and got here at whatever they do in Wall Street, 9 or whatever, I was working like 80 hours a week, this woman is working 40. She got promoted before I did. And to the guy's credit, he said, I got to figure this out. And that's what he wrote the article about. And he said, so I did some thinking and some observation. This woman did way fewer things, but she did the really important stuff and she did it really well. And this guy said, I'm trying to do 40 things to show people how connected I am and how much stuff. And it turns out that a few things done really, really well are more important than, anyway, that's quite a lesson from a guy who said, my only objective is to move up the corporate ladder. And he realized that his lack of pruning and his willing to do anything was actually backfiring. Okay, now this is the most important part of what I'm going to say, I think. Gifting and limitations and uniqueness. And I, you know, I'm not, if you knew me, I'm kind of like the engineer you'd expect me to be. And I'm not too far off of that. But one thing I'm trying to do is, you know, listen to the Holy Spirit a little bit more. And as I was praying about this time, taking a little bit of risk here, I felt like God saying, this is the most important thing you're going to say today. So maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But this is what actually, I think, caused my panic attacks. And I also think it's probably the most universal thing that people do that messes up their sustainability. And I think I've been tempted to do it already today after walking into this hotel, not before, but once I got here. And maybe you have been too. And we'll get to that, why that is. Okay.
All right.
False expectations crush you. And this is kind of a double meaning. I sometimes don't have false expectations because they can crush you. False expectations crush you, crushed me. And that the world and even ourselves will set up expectations that we have to reject and say, wait a second, that's not true. That is not a valid expectation of me. For me, a really strong one is, God loves me based on how much I can achieve and produce. Right? Performance orientation. Right? Is that true? No, it's not true. It's true that it's a false expectation. Yes, it is not true. And so, you know, if I think, because I'll use me, because I do this, that God loves me how much I can achieve and produce, that turns me into a driven person. Right? And it's bad. It's driven in the bad sense. Okay? My value to others is what I can achieve and produce. Okay? And that's not true either. My mom doesn't achieve or produce a whole heck of a lot, to tell you the truth. You know, she's late 80s, and does she have value? Yeah. I mean, she's great value, right? But does she achieve and produce a lot? No. Actually, this is true. At Intel, it's true. Your value to the company is what you achieve and produce. It's true. It's okay. I mean, there's no harm in that as long as you realize that's not your life and that's not your value. Another one, I must be perfect for God to use me. Okay? That's a pretty false expectation. There's a verse in Proverbs, you know, the horse is made ready for the day of battle, but victory rests in the Lord. Most of you are probably familiar with that one, right? I realized that I kind of subconsciously or mentally put some extra words in there that aren't there. when the horse is perfectly prepared for the day of battle, you know, victory rests in the Lord. It's like, there's no such thing as perfect preparation for anything, right? And I thought, you know, okay, it's like, my part is the preparation, you know, I gotta do it perfectly. Not possible. I must meet the expectations of others. I'm an elder at Cedar Mill Bible Church here in town, and I have been for some time. One time, somebody who was in the and sometimes we have different responsibilities as elders. One time for me, it was children's ministry that I kind of oversaw. This woman who was an important leader in that said, you know, it'd be really good if you could know the name of every kid in the children's ministry. It would be really good. I mean, that part was true. or part of the state, it's partially true. It would be nice if I could know. I mean, I have a hard time remembering people, you know, that I work closely with even sometimes. That's completely unrealistic. And to accept that as an expectation would be completely bad. But somebody offered it to me with good intention. I mean, they weren't trying to, you know, mess with me. It was good intentioned and would be good, but completely bogus expectation for me to accept on myself. And I had a personal, like, management coach. One of the privileges of Intel is, you know, you get these high dollar value management coaches, and I've had several of those, you know. And this one woman who was great, she said, people will offer you expectations and patterns that you need to reject. And I, you know, so it's going to come up. Her, you know, offer you. They will be there. These expectations will be there, and I need to say no to them. Now that I'm, oh, another one. My panic attack started right after I became fellow, which at fellow is like VP at Intel. It's a really big deal. And not that big a deal, but I mean, it was, I thought, wow, do I measure up to this? I must work harder now that I have this role, which is another bogus expectation. I think the bottom line is there are always going to be more good things, in fact, eternally significant things, to do than I can possibly do. At work, I use the example, there's always going to be more important email to read, you know, before I go home. There's always going to be. If I say I it's important for me, I can't go home until I finish doing everything important, you know, it's impossible. Does that make sense? Track with me? Okay, and then this one, compositing. I did this. This is my word. I don't think it's a psychological term, but it's what, when I look around me, and when I was named a fellow, I look at the other fellows and take their best characteristic and take all the best characteristics of all the people around me, combine them into one image of what I should be. What, you know, like, do you guys who are pastors or have been pastors or whatever, you know, I'm sure, you know, pastors around town have different gifts and different things. I should be, like, super deep like this guy, and I should be super warm like this guy, and I should be strategic like this other person. And you make, I should be all those things, and that's bogus. So I did that at work. One guy was on The Tonight Show explaining how computers worked. One of my peers on The Tonight Show, it was a long time ago, but for entertainment, explaining how computers worked and people watched, right? I should be a compelling speaker like that. I'm a fellow. I need to be like that. I should be able to go on the Tonight Show and people want to watch me. You know, that's pretty far from who I am, but I should. Another guy, Intel has these guys, world's expert in some field of science, like this one guy, world's expert on transistors. He's so deep. I mean, professors come to him. I should be that deep in my specialty. Another person, broad. You know, they understand a lot about everything. They're not the deepest, but they understand a lot about everything. I should be like that. I need it. Another person was really good at asking questions to get insight. I'm more, my natural style is more, I don't understand something, I kind of attack it. And I had this guy, he'd ask a really nice question. And the truth, if it was a bad idea, it would become apparent because the person would stumble on their answer. I think that's a really good sign. I should be like that. So you see, I had a whole image of I should be like that. And of course, how did I measure up with that image? I didn't. Not even close. Okay, at work. at church, I'm an elder, and I'm sitting there and mentally going around the elder board around the table. This guy, you know, like the pastor, he's a really good Bible. He really knows the Bible. I should know the Bible like that. I don't. I should know the Bible like that. This other guy, super organized. You know, I love the way this person can organize our meetings. I'm not like that. I should be like that. Another guy, super warm. You know, which is like I said, I'm kind of a typical engineer. I love people, but you meet me and I'm not instantaneously the warmest person I'd love to be, but I'm not. But this guy is super warm. I mean, anybody who meets this guy, oh, they feel so loved. I should be like that. Another person was really good at counseling or really good at dealing with difficult situations. Well, look around, I'm not like any of those things. I should be all those things. How did I feel about being an elder? Pretty bad, right? It crushed me, it killed me. I mean, this is where these panic attacks came from, and anxiety and all that kind of stuff. By having these, buying into some false expectations and making a composite of all the great people around, right? And I mentioned, I'll bet some of it's happened to some of you today. When I came in late, but I came in and was to the tail end of Andrew and Wendy, and I know them, and I'm thinking, gosh, you know, they have a really good presence, you know? I think, and so cool, you can tell they love each other just from the way they banter and the way they look at each other, and I think, that's really cool. I should be like that. I caught myself. It's a great thing they have. I should admire that. I should be happy about it, and I should have a good marriage, which I do, but I don't need to be like them, and my wife and I are never going to be on stage like that. And that's fine. But, you know, and I'll bet you guys, because you're all here meeting people, right, and have different ministries, and you're finding people that have gifts and abilities that you don't have. I'm sure of it, actually. Hopefully you don't do what I am tempted to do, but in this room, I mean, I'm sure that anyone of you can, hopefully has met someone in this conference that has a gift or ability that you don't have, or not even close to having. There's two reactions you can have to that. I didn't really want to do that. Two reactions. You can react to that with appreciation and joy, kind of, boy, it's cool that God made that person that way, and that's going on. Or you can start using, I should be like that.
Yeah, I have a question on that, because I work with a lot of mentors.
Uh-huh.
And I work with myself. I have some younger kids that I'm mentoring. Mm-hmm. And with my mentors, the first thing is, well, you know, you need to act more like me. So I put in the pressure that I need to be more like them. And this is coming from the Bible, this is coming from Jesus and the disciples, and this is coming, you know, Paul writing, be imitators of me, like I'm of Christ, right?
Yeah.
So how do you message compared to that message, how do you rewind it there?
I'll talk about that in the next slide.
Okay.
I will, seriously. That's a really good question. And I think that some Christians put a lot of pressure on people. And when I was in college, the Christian ministry I was part of, probably not intentionally, but it happened. You felt a ton of pressure to be certain things. Like for me, honestly, I felt, there's another talk I've given at the Plow Association, and that's why it's not a second-class citizen in the kingdom of God to work in a secular job. Because when I was in college, most of my friends that were serious about God ended up having a vocational Christian career. I didn't. I spent most of my life feeling like a second-class citizen. And that kind of pressure happens. No, I don't think anybody set out saying we should make everybody who doesn't have a vocational Christian career feel bad. I'm sure nobody did that, but it happened. And you're just probably unintentional too, but I'll get to that. Let's get to that. But first I want to say, God doesn't even want us to be all those things. You know, when I talk about expectations and the compositing, First, I thought that would be good. Yeah, I went through a progression. First, I should be all those things. Secondly, there's no way I'm going to be all those things, but it'd be great if I was. You know, wouldn't that be cool? And then it's a second transformation. It'd be bad if I was all those things. That's not how God designed us to be. We're, you know, it talks about gifts. When God talks about gifts, it's usually about interdependence in the body. You know, this person has that gift, I have this gift. Together, we do stuff. Not that we're all self-sufficient, completely able to do all things. Does that make sense? To me, it's a really important revelation to think, it'd be good, first, I think I should do those things. Secondly, I thought, I can't possibly do those things, but it would be good. And now it's right, nah, that's not even God's plan. God makes us all different and puts us in communities, so we need each other. We're not self-contained, you know, able to do all things, have every strength, have every gift kind of people. Because think about what life would be if we were like that. You guys, we probably wouldn't even be here. We'd have, you know, hundreds of different people just doing their own thing somewhere. Why have a conference to learn from each other? Because we're all got all gifts. That's not the way God designed it, I think. Now, and I'm also a little nervous because you guys probably know a lot more, have a lot more theological training than I do. But I really think this is true, that God does not want, didn't design it for people to have all spiritual gifts. Okay, so your question, I think, is kind of related to this. Yeah, it's true, but you're not those guys. Your mentors, or the people you're mentoring, they are different than you. They have different giftings and different callings. And so, yeah, they should learn from you and imitate your passion for God. Imitate your commitment to Scripture, imitating some of those things, but not imitating the way you sleep, not imitating the way you, you know, if you, I don't know, you're probably a warm, you know, everybody loves you kind of guy. Not thinking that everybody you mentor is that. I mean, everybody you mentor should strive to love, but it doesn't mean their style is the instantly warm, because I can't do that. I mean, I think it'd be great if I could, but that's, I mean, I'm a task-oriented numbers person. I'm an engineer. That's good, actually. I didn't used to think so, but I think it's great now. If you're mentoring me and you say, Rick, you're a cold, dispassionate person, you should be different, be more like me, that's going to crush me, because I know I would love to be warmer. I'm just not. It doesn't mean I don't love people. And actually, I say, people who are my friends think I'm really loyal and really loving, and my wife says I'm really loving. So my big strength is I love her too much. My style is different than yours, okay? But loving, so it's like imitating the thing. Try love people, love God, commitment to Scripture, all those sorts of things. Those are great things to imitate. Exactly how you do that. You have your quiet time or some devotional time at 4 a.m. Well, maybe you can do that. I can't. And if you set that as a standard, you're going to crush me. You could say, hey, Rick, you should have a time every day to pray, read the Bible, be quiet. Yes. Okay? But say it's got to be 4 a.m.? No. Yeah?
Yeah, so the way I think about it is the goal is godliness, but the way you get there, the means that you get there might be different from you.
Yeah, exactly. 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 And trying to copy somebody else's way is what turns out not to be sustainable to me. And what generates anxiety and generates people feeling bad and crushes us.
You mind if I have something?
Yeah.
I think I have people in my life who I try to follow too, so I kind of know where you're coming from as far as like, I have people put pressure on you. And one thing that I realize, seek to understand, it has more to do with principles than it has to do necessarily with style.
Yeah, well said. That's a more articulate way of saying what I wanted to say.
My wife and I, we have very different styles. I wish she was here, but she just took off. But anyways, yeah, we just have different styles in the way we like love people, the way we express ourselves. But we follow the same principles at the end of the day.
Yeah. Yep. Good. Okay, so my test, go ahead.
You know, evangelism, depending on what, where you're at, defines love too.
Mm-hmm.
We go and administer to people that are unlovable, that can kill you, that are extremely hateful. So you have to love unconditionally, as Christ did.
Have
patience.
Yep.
Because you don't get instant.
Not instant, huh? No. Just quick.
You have to work around for years and hoping to get very little return. So like you said earlier with the marathon and the sprint.
Okay, so you probably saw, it's like I was talking about Andrew and Wendy and seeing them, and my temptation is to see them and say, ah, they're so great on stage together. I love that. But then my wife and I aren't that. Doesn't mean we don't love each other as much or anything. It's just we're not that. And in the past, I would frequently go to, we should be like that. It's a deficiency. We should feel bad about it. To now it's like, I should appreciate that. It's great that they are. And it's great that I'm something else. So my test is, do I appreciate that in other people? Or do I feel inadequate because of that in other people? And you guys have a great test here, right? People with all sorts of different... What's that?
You should appreciate.
Oh, yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. That's the test. If you appreciate, that's right. Feeling inadequate, that's wrong.
I mean, you hear somebody saying in church that's got the gift.
Yeah.
You know.
Yep.
Now, there's other people that try, and it may sound like, Lord, don't
put your faith on. Yeah. That's right. But this is my personal test question. If I got the right attitude about other people and their gifts. Do I appreciate it? Do I enjoy it? Do I think it's great? Or do I go to myself and think about myself and think, I'm not that, and feel inadequate? And like I said, a temptation here, with so many people doing so many cool things and so much gifting, you could really get yourself that way. I'm going to a thing on Monday, which is all the fellows at Intel getting together, which is a bunch of, and I know that's going to be a temptation. It's like, wow, that guy, so cool. I'm not like that. Yes?
Rick, I think there's a good example, really, from our own bodies, how they're designed, that show us how we should appreciate things that we may not be compatible with.
Yes. Yes, if I'm not a foot or whatever.
We had a friend who was lived in the area of Packard, Washington, up in the mountains, right? And so he got sick one night and started throwing up, and it got worse and worse. Mm-hmm. His wife finally called the ambulance, and they hauled him off to Centralia, and they flew him up to Seattle to a trauma center. He had ruptured the esophagus.
Mm-hmm.
And that meant that stomach acids were getting out in the soft tissue. Right? Stomach acid and soft tissue is not very compatible.
Yeah, it's digesting.
They're both very necessary.
Yeah.
Right? And so the thing that I learned from that really was that part of this, our bodies are designed so that some parts are not really compatible with each other. Doesn't mean that we should necessarily feel like we have to be doing or compatible necessarily with everybody in the body of Christ on a personal level.
Yeah.
But we need to appreciate their contributions because we each have a part to play. We're being part of what God has created us to do. We do our part.
Yep.
And we do it to the best of our ability. And we acknowledge that there are other parts of the body we may not even necessarily want to be around.
Yeah.
But they're still important to the whole body of Christ.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. So a question for you to take a few minutes on. What expectations or thought patterns do you have that attack your sustainability?
You were lost earlier.
I think a lot of that derives from fear.
What's that?
A lot of that derives from fear.
Hmm.
You know, it just goes back to that, where you're talking about how you feel like you have to work for your salvation or for God's approval. It's fear-based. Or at your day job, only you're fired if I'm not.
Yeah, yep.
That once.
Yep.
Got one back there.
Yes.
We were just talking about this a couple minutes ago, but it's a lot of times we have like where we want to be, but it's like, oh man, I don't know all the steps to get there. And so, you know, sometimes that can cause fear and action and just that thought pattern of it's okay not to have all the steps figured out.
Mm-hmm.
The Lord directs the steps and just trust in that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so the reason I brought up all these different things and attitudes and the additional ones you're bringing up is they, if we don't deal with those, I think they're just like stomach acid attacking the body. I mean, they are corrosive. They are things that will get you. In my case, you know, I started getting panic attacks. In your case, you might get an ulcer or something else, or they just talked about generalized ill health, or who knows what it is. But holding on to these attitudes hurts us badly, and it impacts our ministries, and it impacts our ability to keep doing it. And so that's really the point. Yes?
I was thinking here, and I think one of the biggest, that comparison trap, it's very easy for me to fall in. My husband is an evangelist, and he travels quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I feel like, it's not necessarily the pressure that others put on me, but that I put on myself. Mm-hmm. I have to be good at everything. Mm-hmm. I have to be good at speaking in public. I have to be good at children's ministry. I have to be good at praying with people. I have to be good at everything.
Yeah.
And what I find is that, because I'm not good at everything, obviously, I end up not doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm trying to focus on being good in too many
things,
as opposed to trying to focus on those things that I'm really good at, and doing those things well.
Yeah. So it's, that's good. That's good point. It's like watching Wendy, right? Well, she's the wife of an evangelist, and she's an evangelist in her own right, and she might even be more gifted than he is. And yeah, I know how the thought pattern goes. Yeah.
I think pride like really attacks sustainability.
Mm-hmm.
I just started seminary. My wife and I just moved from California to Louisville, Kentucky for seminary, and I took my first quiz like a week ago, and I was super bummed because I missed one. I got a 95 on the quiz, and I was so upset. And so we were going, we were eating dinner, and when we went to pray for dinner, I started praying, Lord, like, please forgive me for missing one on my quiz, and please help me get 100% next time for your glory, for your glory, Lord. And my wife, she backed out of the prayer. She said, stop right now. She said, you don't want 100% for his glory. You want 100% for
your glory. Right. And in fact, the answer to that prayer is probably you're not getting a whole lot of 100%. Probably.
Praise the Lord for godly wives. And blessed me. But man, pride is a killer.
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, thank you. Okay, so kind of close to wrapping up, and then we can have a few more Q&A kind of things. But I want everybody to remember, you know, we're not all the same. We're not all have the same gifting. So even how you respond to this stuff about sleep or exercise and all that, it's all going to be individual. There's no person to copy on all these things, right? It's how do you apply the principles to you, okay? And then remember that when we talk about all these things, Jesus says, my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Okay, so when I think about these things, it kind of makes me want to be gratitude and thank God for a couple things that I know are true, that I used not to know were true. I know my values. I thank God that my value is not in my production. I'm a pretty productive guy, but I thank God that my value is not my production, because production can be taken away at any time. And I'm really thankful that my value as a person can't be taken away. I don't need to anxiously toil. You know, I do need to work. We need to work hard, but it doesn't need to be anxious toil like my relationship with God depends on it, or my life depends on it. It doesn't. It depends on God's blessing, right? Hard work is good, but anxious toil is bad. I'm thankful for that. I'm thankful that I don't need to meet the false expectations given to me by the world or even by myself that I give myself. I don't need to meet those expectations of being a peer of the composite best of all my peers. That's crazy. Or that I need to learn all the names of all the kids in Sunday school. I don't need to do those things. God doesn't expect. I don't need to accept those false expectations that aren't from God. I'm thankful for that. I'm thankful that I don't need to have all strengths and gifts. God's given me a few. I'm thankful for them. I'm thankful that I'm an engineer. I'm not a pastor. I'm not an evangelist. I'm not, you know, the instantly warm person. But I am. But I'm thankful that I don't need to be. That who God has made me to be is sufficient. And I'm thankful that God says, Jesus says, my burden is easy and my yoke is light. When I think about these things, that's life-giving to me, and sustainability kind of in a nutshell, right? And the opposite of these things are what drives unsustainability. Okay, so that's what I hopefully that was of some value to me. Hopefully that was some value to me. Hopefully you give me 100% there on the evaluation form, Mr. Missed one question. No. Hopefully this is some value to you. Some value to you, and you know, I offer my personal experiences to you in hopes that it's helpful. We've got like 10 minutes for Q&A or whatever you want to say. Go ahead, sir.
I got two schools of thought. As a pastor, head pastor. What you have to do, I'll use the NFL and the military for two categories. Mm-hmm. NFL, if you're lucky enough to get there, you're paid to play a position.
Mm-hmm.
You have a skill set to play that position.
Yeah.
When you put that uniform on Sunday, you got to perform. Now, good players learn to play other positions. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's your weakness.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's how you're working. Concentrate on the position you're playing and the skill set it gave you. Now, in the military world, I'm a combat vet.
Mm.
One bullet from a sniper can change a battle.
Mm.
One. Them are special breed. So that he's to be appreciated. He may fire one round all day. But he's going to take somebody else that's going to make a difference. So what I think the Lord is saying here, concentrate on the gifting that he gives you. You can work on some negative things, but don't let it eat you up.
Mm-hmm.
Concentrate on the positive.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. Okay.
We actually only have 1 minute.
1 minute.
Yeah.
Okay. We actually have 1 minute because we started late. Yeah. 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 Okay. So, yes, Rosemary.
Mine is sort of like a testimony about a pastor we sat under who had anxiety as a child. But then a few years ago, he experienced 40 days of anxiety.
Hmm.
And it just flattened him.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the way God used it for him as well as for our congregation was a good number of people got around him and prayed with him during that time. And God has really, you know, given a demonstration of healing that I think many of us need.
Yeah. I should say that, you know, like I said, I had panic attacks very badly for a while, and I don't at all anymore. And I am thankful for that time because I would have been carrying these false, I mean, before I had the panic attacks, I didn't think about this stuff deeply, and now I have, and it's been life-changing, and I'm thankful for it, even though it was not a fun time, because it forced me to address some, you know, false expectations and false values and some ways that God, that I thought I related to God that weren't true. Anyway, okay, I'll hang around a little bit. Everybody has any further questions?